My opinion is that I miss my old football. I miss my old football with goal line technology.
Hello and welcome to the Sound of Football podcast. I'm Graham Sibley, and as ever, I'm joined by Jan Bilton.
Hello.
And Terry DeFellin.
Hello.
Well, we had a great week last week, didn't we, on the podcast. John Driscoll came in to tell us all about his great book and also to have a chat with us. It wasn't just all about selling his book. He wouldn't be like that. I mean, like, he's always welcome here, isn't he? He's always welcome to come along, and it just so happened that he was selling a book. That kind of dominated the conversation, but we were actually talking about influential players, weren't we, guys? Well, you two weren't. You were remarkably quiet throughout the whole conversation. What was wrong, Terry? Why were you so quiet?
Well, I was feeling fairly distant at that time. I felt positively remote. I almost felt as if I wasn't there.
We were really out the back having a smoke.
We both decided to take up smoking again because it's just tons more fun and we look cool.
Yeah, we did look cool.
Girls came up and talked to us. It was brilliant.
It was good.
Yeah, that sounds rather seedy nowadays.
True.
But I suppose lots of people have got books coming out, it being close to Christmas and all that. There's going to be loads of football books coming out. So I suppose really it's only fair that we should give everyone who's got a book coming out some fair coverage, shouldn't we, really? Throw them a bone, so to speak. So, Terry, have you seen any new books coming out recently?
Well, as a matter of fact, I have actually seen that there's a new book that looks very exciting.
Oh, really? Tell us more.
Oh, shall I? It's called From the Jaws of Victory, and it's an anthology about these great teams that very, very nearly won the lot, but failed either at the last minute or in the last game or in the last month, or teams like, you know, the Hungary team of 1954, you know, Leeds United in 1970. Brazil 82, of course, is a good one. And, of course, Bayer Leverkusen 2001-2002. And lots of other ones, like Arsenal 2005-06 is there as well. So, and there's a whole host of distinguished and some less than distinguished writers. Our friend Rob Langham is doing the Brazil game. Nicky Bandini is doing the Arsenal 2005-2006. Marcelo Mora, who a fantastic Argentine writer, is doing Argentina from 2006 to 2014. Daniel Story's on there, Patrick Barkley's there, John Ashdown, Scott Murray, Johnny Nick, some fantastic writers, and I'm on there too.
My word. Are you?
You were doing so well there, Terry.
I know. I just thought I thought I had to slip that in because listeners might wonder why on earth I'm banging on about this book. It's because I'm in it too. I've written the Bayer Leverkusen chapter. Yeah, it's called From the Jaws of Victory. And it's on pre-order right now, listeners, at the low, low price of $8.99. And if you order it, you know, in the next few days, then you should be able to get it before it goes up to its full price of $10.99. So hopefully Graham will be kind enough to add the links on the show notes so that our listeners can buy it.
I certainly will, certainly will. So you will be able to get in there. Terry, when did you get involved in that then?
They're just before the lockdown. Listeners may well be aware, because I may have mentioned it once or twice, that I've written another book, a full-length book on Borussia Dortmund, and that's going through, I believe, post-production now is the inaccurate term to it. But while that was been going on, I got approached by Adam and Rob, Magic Sponges, who are putting this book together. They did an anthology a few years ago called Falling for Football, which some listeners may be aware of. And they told me the idea of the theme and said, we're looking for somebody to write about Bayer Leverkusen. And so I put my hand up and said, I'll do that. So, yeah, that's how it happened.
Oh, sounds fun. Sounds fun. Did you talk to any of the other contributors while you were doing it? I know you say Rob Langham, friend of the show's there. Other Socrates alumni are also on there. I think Andy Thomas and Stuart Fuller, they're on there, aren't they?
Andy and Stuart are on there. No. I mean, in fairness, it didn't take me terribly long to write. The main guy I spoke to was a guy called Eric Brule, who I believe was once upon a time a regular listener to The Sound of Football. And he used to be the podcast host of the Neverkusen podcast. Very much a dyed-in-the-wool Leverkusen fan, and he gave me the generosity of his time. I could get an email from Rob saying, I've seen your name on the list, and it's great, good to see you. Because I think we both sort of like felt, blimey, there's quite a few big name reporters and writers on this, and then there's us. But I'm sure we will pass muster.
Yes, I'm sure it will. Well, I can't wait to read it, and I will be ordering my copy very soon, because I won't be getting a free one off Terry.
Nope, no freebies.
Friends pay, right?
Friends pay. Dan's face is really scrunched up. Yeah, he doesn't find that funny at all.
I don't find that funny at all. If it involves me parting with money, I don't like it one bit. So I'm very disappointed I'm not getting any free stuff.
Yes, you're here to be Northern, and thank you for providing us with that.
Cheers, Jan.
No problem. No problem. Well done, by the way, Terry, or something like that.
Yes.
Great. We can move on now, I think.
That is From the Jaws of Victory, and that's by Halcyon Publishing, and it is out now. And as Terry said, $8.99. We will put the links up on the website so you'll be able to find it and order a copy yourself. Well, let's get on with what we're actually going to be talking about this week, shall we? After that shameless pluggery.
Rampant commercialism. Can we just stop for 5 minutes while I go and take a shower?
Yeah, that's the one thing about us being independent, you see. We don't have the adverts. But when we do,
we didn't have adverts until 2 weeks ago. Didn't we? We have them every bloody week. Unbelievable. It's like working on ITV.
Or QVC, I think, more like it.
You'd have thought it would have been easier when it's your own stuff, but no, it really isn't. It really isn't.
You still feel as dirty and as shameful, don't you?
We've sold out to the man, haven't we?
Yeah, but seriously, listeners, buy the book. Yeah, just buy it. Got years of free stuff, 3 years of free content. So come on, make with the cash.
Yes. Well, anyway, this week we're going to be talking about penalties. Penalties, VAR, because we like talking about VAR, and it's been a long time since we talked about VAR. So we're going to be talking about VAR, penalties in the Premier League, and chicanery, because there has been some chicanery this week. Also, people are accusing people of chicanery, and people are using strong terms about it as well. So this weekend, there were 8 Premier League games. There was 2 on Monday night while we were recording. 4 of those 8 games were decided by penalties. 4 penalties awarded for 4 results. There was penalties in the Arsenal Man United game. There was a penalty in the Newcastle game for Liverpool and for Tottenham as well. They both won games with crucial penalties in there. Now, the one in the Arsenal-Man United game was pretty straightforward. It was a late challenge from Paul Pogba. Hector Bellerin went down, got the penalty. Not too much of a complaint about that, really. Though I think quite a lot of the criticism of Paul Pogba has been, I don't want to say unfair, but it's been a bit strong considering the performance of the side of a whole. The Callum Wilson incident was weak, a soft penalty, but it was a penalty nonetheless. But the other two incidents are the ones we're really going to be concentrating on. That's the Harry Kane one, the foul committed by Adam Lallana, and the Mo Salah one against West Ham, the offender there being Arthur Masuaka. Jan, I'm going to start with you first. We'll talk about the Mo Salah one. Now, there's been a lot of outcry on social media and in the press as well that Salah dived. What was your take on that one?
Yeah, I think he dived.
Yeah,
I don't think it was a penalty. There's no doubt that he was there was contact. He was touched. You can't dispute that. You can see it fairly clearly. Ball was played over to him. He was on. It's fair to say the corner of the penalty area. So I mean, he was still posing a threat, but possibly not a direct threat. And he was caught while trying to control the ball. Actually, I wouldn't even say he was caught. He was tapped on the back of the heel. And then it looked like somehow he'd stepped on a landmine or something like that, because he went down very, very easily and very, very dramatically. I don't think that contact was enough to bring him down. That type of thing happens all the time, all over the pitch, in my view. It's not nice to call someone a cheat, but he cheated. 100%.
Strong words there, Terry. Obviously, in slow motion, challenges look a hell of a lot worse than they actually are. Do you think Masuaka's challenge was anywhere near enough to bring down Salah?
It probably wasn't enough to bring him down, no. I mean, if it had happened anywhere else on the pitch, it's likely that Salah would have tried to ride the challenge out and kept going. But it happened in the penalty area, and bluntly. I mean, you can agree or disagree with the tactic behind it, but I mean, the reality is that he felt the tap, and I would suggest to you, under the laws of the game and the way that they're officiated, that that is sufficient to earn a penalty, and so he went down. It's always unedifying to watch players go down easily. It makes the player look bad, and I don't think he does particularly well for the overall spectacle of a football match. But the fact is that when you're that close to the goal, when you're in the penalty area, when you've got that much of a chance to score a goal, if a player, you know, impedes you, even in the slightest way, then I think, personally, if he was my player, I'd want him to go down and win that penalty. I appreciate that my colleague Jan disagrees with that wholeheartedly, and I would suggest that this is a philosophical gulf between the pair of us as to how we think the game should be played. For me, I don't really have a problem with it, but I completely respect how it works up people. But I wouldn't say he cheated, because I don't believe he did cheat. And also, as much as I dislike VAR, you know, the whole point of VAR is to double-check the rules in these situations. And if they've had a look at it, then you'd have to say that it was correct. You can argue the law is an ass, but if I was a Liverpool fan, I'd want Salah to go down and earn that penalty.
Yeah, I mean, don't get me wrong. If I was a Liverpool fan, I'd want him to go down and earn that penalty. As I find myself saying nearly every week, if it was my team, I'd definitely want it. So, yeah, I'm nothing if I'm not a hypocrite. But yeah, as a spectator, I found it distasteful and didn't like it. I thought Bellerin actually made sure he got that penalty as well.
Totally. Yeah, he didn't have to go down.
He was definitely fouled. And you know, Willian's ball through was incredible. Bellerin ran across Pogba, and Pogba was sluggish, really. But Bellerin did.
Yeah.
He made sure that everyone knew he'd been touched.
Oh, yeah. He places his foot squarely on the ground after he's had his foot trodden on. But he does take a pace before he falls down. And I don't think it's because he's unbalanced he falls down. He falls down because he thinks, I better fall down now.
Yeah. But that was a much more dynamic piece of football, if you like, because the player was flowing, and Pogba did look, I mean, you see it even at normal speed, and it just looks like he lunged at him, really, didn't he? Sorry, I know we weren't talking about this one. But because both penalties were, though the one on Bellerin was slightly heavier, but only slightly, and the reaction of the players was, you could argue, disproportionate. I think it's important to bring that in, but I think that the flow of the lead up to that penalty was kind of lends itself more to it being given, you know. Whereas Salah's one, I've made my point on that. I wasn't particularly happy with that, and I think a great player like Salah let himself down a bit there.
Well, it has actually caused quite a bit of anger amongst ex-pros as well. Tony Cascarino, in his regular Monday column in The Times, with the headline, Mo Salah's dive was an insult to Nobby Styles and the game he loved.
Wow. That is a statement, isn't it?
Did he actually say that, Greg, or is that just like a sub-editor, you know, having fun?
It's got his picture above the words, yeah.
Was that in The Times, you said, as well?
Yep.
That, wow. I mean, if that was in any other rag.
I mean, I know you've got to get your clicks, haven't you? But, oh, wow. This is all part of the pantomime, isn't it, really? I mean, like to be outraged at someone diving to win a penalty when he has been knocked, these are the rules of the game. If you don't challenge someone correctly in the penalty area, you're likely to have a penalty awarded against you.
Yeah, but it's a bit much saying that Nobby Styles is going to be turning in his grave because of that.
If it had been, you know, the laws of the game as they're currently interpreted are an affront to Nobby Styles and the way that he played the game, then obviously that's a much longer and less interesting headline. Nobby Styles, may he rest in peace, of course, was a very, very physical player of the game, as we know, is well known for it, and probably very, very rough. And his style of play, you know, he wouldn't have managed too well, I think, you know, had he been transported in time to 2020 and asked to play professional football, he wouldn't have done very well. But, I mean, you know, I think it's a bit much to pin it all on one player.
Yeah, obviously, as well, you've got algorithms you've got to satisfy. You need to have Nobby Styles in your headlines for all that search traffic. It just reeks of opportunism there, that of just trying to make a headline out of words that you know are going to do well. And of course, it's done well. Look, we're talking about it. So anyway, we'll come back to the Salah penalty decision, but we'll talk about the Kane one now. Terry, what was your view on that one?
Well, on the first look, I thought, hey, how's that a penalty? That's outside the box.
Yeah.
But I mean, as it transpires, no. I mean, his feet are firmly planted before they've become firmly unplanted on the white line, on the border of the penalty area and the rest of the pitch. And Adam Lallana has been you know, clumsy. It's not a very artful tackle. It's not a particularly nasty of tackle. It's not really a tackle at all, is it? It's just him trying to win a ball with that from Harry Kane, which is a difficult thing to do, particularly if you're a live attack-minded midfielder. Again, Kane, you know, went down easily, but at the same time, you know, he was clearly fouled.
Was he? You think so? Jan is shaking his head here, and I'm thinking I'm going to go on Team Bilton for this one. Jan, come on.
Yeah, I have to point out, this is not opposition for the sake of opposition. I genuinely don't agree with my colleague. So as the ball was cleared out of defence, Harry Kane is backing it, so he's facing the goal and he's starting to move backwards. Obviously, the contact was made inside the penalty area, so there's little doubt about that. But he looks back and sees Adam Lallana coming to him and keeps proceeding in the same direction backwards.
Yeah.
And Adam Lallana clatters into the back of him. I actually think that was a really, really dangerous thing for Harry Kane to do. And that could have played itself out very, very differently had Lallana not landed the way he did. I mean, it still looked like a bloody awful landing. He actually landed partly on Kane, which probably helped him out. But, you know, he only has to be a few degrees different in his form there, and he's landing on a shoulder or a neck, and that could have been really awful, really. So I had a similar view straight away. I thought it was outside of the area, so I share that sentiment. But once you look at it through in slow motion, as the VAR chaps will have done, they'll have seen that, you know, there's little doubt in my mind that Kane was deliberately backing there, looking for that penalty. You know, the fact it was given, you know, fine. But the reality is, I think that was a dangerous challenge by Kane, if I'm honest. And I think if it had gone the other way, I don't think many people would have been too surprised.
I agree with you there. It's one of those instances where Kane is not making any attempt at all to win the ball, but he's not holding his ground. He's not as if he's said, well, I don't have to get out of the way for you to win the ball. Lallana has gone up and made a genuine attempt for the ball, whereas Kane is backing into Lallana and actually backing into the position where he's jumping from. And yeah, it is dangerous because there is no way that Lallana can break his fall. He's got to go over Kane. It's cute play from Kane. He knows he's going to win the free kick because players do win the free kick in that situation. There was a very similar incident to that in the Arsenal United game. It was an Arsenal defender did the same thing and won the free kick. He just stood his ground. The United player went up in the air to try and win the ball and went over the top of the defender, gave away the free kick. In the commentary, they were saying, well, I'm surprised it didn't actually go the other way. It's because you've got one player not making any attempt to play the ball at all, and you've got another one there trying to make a genuine attempt to try and win it. Now, this wasn't the only contentious decision in the game and not the only time that the VAR was called in, because for Brighton's equaliser, there was a foul in the build-up, but what looked like a foul, and the referee actually went over and checked it out on the screen and said, no, not a foul. Any opinion on that, Terry?
Yeah, I saw that. I thought that was a foul.
Yeah.
I was very surprised. I thought for all that, it looked to me like it was a foul. There was no contact made with the ball. I'm not quite entirely certain why that wasn't a foul. So that one has left me baffled, I'm afraid. Maybe they felt that it happened, the time gap between the goal, the foul being committed and the goal being scored was too long. And they thought that maybe, but for me, it looked like it was a pivotal moment in the scoring of that goal. You know, the ball was going in the other direction, literally, until that foul happened. And then it was suddenly going in a different direction. So I can't see why that one was not chalked off.
Hmm. So what do we think VAR cocked up there?
Oh, what would be nice to know would be to get some kind of feedback from referees as to why that was okay, why that goal was allowed to stand in view of that foul. And if there are any referees listening, maybe they can feed us back to that.
Now, this season, we've got the referees actually going to use the monitors. So we do actually have the benefit of two referees seeing the replays. If the referees are seeing that incident and thinking, no, that was perfectly within the rules of the game, or if they were looking at the other incidents like what Kane did or what Salah did, looking at that on a screen, whether it's just the VAR or whether it's the VAR and the referee, is the major problem now the fact that we don't understand football and referees do, rather than there being a problem with VAR?
There's nothing wrong with the technology of VAR. You know, it shows what it shows, doesn't it? thing is with football, as we've said many, many times before, a lot of it's down to interpretation. It's not like a line call in tennis or whatever. It's in or out. It's, you know, there's not many things that are black and white. You know, you have to take into account the context in which the situation you're adjudicating happened. So, we're still here. We are, you know, well into VAR now, and it's not going to go away ever. But we're still arguing about decisions. And the fact is, decisions are made by humans ultimately. It's not made by the technology. If you want it to be perfect, or if you want it to, you know, as I said ages ago, then just have a machine make that call. You know, there's ball tracking technology that exists that you can see where the lines are. You know, cars can drive themselves. I'm sure a machine can decide whether a player's offside or a ball has struck the hand or whatever. You know, if we want it to be a technological solution, we should do it that way. Because this is not actual solution, is it? VAR isn't a solution. It's a halfway house, isn't it? It's just giving somebody a second bite of the cherry to see the incident. But the reality is it's down to humans, and humans make mistakes.
Yeah, I suppose that's why, Terry, that people like goal line technology, because there isn't a human involved in that, is there? It's all just ball tracking and algorithms, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I don't like goal line technology, to be honest with you. But no. I mean, that's one, partly because I'm a curmudgeon, but also I think of it more in terms of the economics of the game. And I think it's wiser to try and keep the game as cheap to play as possible, even at the elite level. But that's another argument where things get sticky with VAR. In situations like that, a Kane penalty, because there's discord as to, you know, whether or not it's actually a foul. And then it's gone to, you know, one ref official's looked at it and another official's looked at it, and they've reached a decision that, you know, a lot of people clearly just don't agree with. And that hasn't gone away. We don't have that. Whenever people have thought about VAR or video evidence back in the day before it happened, they would look at the really obvious mistakes made by referees and say, this is why we have to have video evidence. When in fact, the issue is really what we just had to have better referees. Whereas now we've got to a point where you know, these marginal calls that can be disputed are now under the VAR microscope, and people are saying, well, you know, this is not resolving any questions. This is not, you know, resolving disputes. This is not making things straightforward. And yeah, I mean, it's one of the reasons why it's probably on balance not a good idea. I don't know about you, but I tend to enjoy watching championship matches more now because they haven't got VAR. Not something that you sort of have to think about too much. You always have it knocking about in there. I've not been able to embrace it as part of the drama of watching football. I find it irritating, the idea that it's sort of like hovering over there.
Yeah, it is. It's like a pantomime villain, isn't it? It's just, you know, it's going to come on at some point and just spoil everything for everyone, or make things better for the other side of the audience.
Yeah,
if you like. Yeah, yeah, exactly. Like we've said before, you know, you get a penalty or you get a goal or whatever, and you're almost waiting to kind of enjoy that moment, aren't you? Whereas in the rest of the football pyramid, you can just enjoy it because it's great.
Do you think that the way in which Harry Kane and Mo Salah won those penalties would have been different before VAR? Do you think that if they were both championship players, they would have gone about that whole situation differently? Would Salah have stayed on his feet, for example? Would Kane not looked over his shoulder to see where Lallana was? Do you think that they're acting because they know that there's a possibility that this is going to get looked at again, and so they can... Do you think that that's kind of worked its way in yet?
I think that there is definitely a possibility that players will go down easier now, knowing that if someone is touched, that's not a dive. Of course it's a dive because they don't have to go down. They're not being impelled to go to the floor by the force of the challenge. They are going down because they choose to go down. So they know that if there is contact, then go down, because it immediately alerts the VAR to look and see whether or not an incident has occurred. Technically, we don't have appeals, but we do. We do have appeals because we have players falling over or throwing their arms up and kicking the ball out just so that there's a break in play, so that the VAR can check on incidents. And if they see anything slightly awry, then they can pull it back. This is the sort of thing that, without the scrutiny of television, would probably have been allowed to pass and pass within the flow of the game. But you can't have that anymore, because you can't have that at any game that's got more than about three or four cameras at. It's the sort of thing that would disappear once you go just a couple of levels down the league.
only the televised championship games have multi cameras, don't they?
Yeah.
Even the rest of the championship will have maybe a three camera setup, which is no good for VAR, and doesn't have, and just doesn't enjoy that level of scrutiny once you get further on down, you know, even into the second tier. What concerns me, and I think I've mentioned this before, but is the shift in which players behave and the way that they play the game is now altered because the way the game has been officiated is different to the rest of the professional game and indeed the rest of the amateur game and not semi-professional game as well. And it's creating a different game, albeit perhaps subtly, and you know, maybe it's not that big a deal, but I do think it is happening.
I do take that point, and I do think you're probably right. There's a high chance that players are behaving differently because they know they've got the cameras on them. But when you've got fewer cameras on players and you see a contentious incident, you know, you've got less to go on. So you're not quite sure whether there is chicanery going on there or not. Or let's say you've got no cameras there at all. You only see it once. So it's difficult to say, I think, just to give the players in the Premier League the benefit of the doubt, it's difficult to say whether they are changing it because you've got so much more opportunity to spot it, whereas you don't have that further down the leagues and into the, you know, into like White Leafs level. I'm not saying there aren't players that throw themselves around in there or try and win something that's not necessarily there because we've seen it, but you don't get as much chance to see it because it's not, you know, it's not replayed for forever and a day.
And the other problem we have is, of course, the problem that we've seen with handball, where we are micro-analysing incidents like the Kane incident or the Mo Salah one. If you try to legislate for those, and if you try to tweak the rules just to try and to get rid of these anomalies in the game, what you end up with is changing the whole game for the 0.1% of football that has VAR.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. Like the offside rule, for example, is just... In fairness, the handball rule is the best example, isn't it? This is a rule that's been refined for VAR, and the overwhelming majority of the world doesn't operate VAR.
And the whole thing about the T-shirt line now, I'm convinced that that is just to make it easier for the VAR offside calls, because you see them now being measured on the outside of the arm rather than on the chest, trying to guess where the arm starts when you've got a side-on view of a player.
The offside one really boils my blood because every bloody time we are shown these green grabs from VAR, almost every time you never see where the ball is in relation. You see where the lines are drawn, but you don't see whether it's not possible to determine the exact moment when a ball is played.
Yeah.
You cannot come up. There is no resolution fine enough to be able to tell you whether or not the ball is one micrometer away from the player's foot having just been played. It's just laughable. You know, we all sit there obsessing about where these lines should be, and yet no one seems to be able to address the fact that it's as the ball is played, and that got it established on VAR. So it's just an arbitrary decision, and just more expensive, that takes more time and hurts attacking football. I genuinely don't understand why anybody continue to defend VAR offside. It's an absolute pup.
Well, I'm sure Sony do, because they sponsor the Champions League for £50 million a year, and they actually own Hawkeye. So I suppose they've got quite a bit invested in it, don't they?
Okay, all right. When I say, all right, obviously, I meant people. I didn't mean corporations.
Yeah, it's all corporations, isn't it, Terry? People have always said, you've got to give it time to bed in. You've got to get used to it. It's still football. But I don't know, it's been around for a few years now, VAR. The World Cup is 2.5 years ago. It's not getting any better as far as I'm concerned. It is as bad, if not, it's even worse, because every time something new comes up, it just shows another weakness in the system rather than the strength of it. And I know more decisions are being correctly called now, but I don't think we're getting a better version of the game with VAR. It's nothing to do about the delays or the micromanagement of the little lines to find out what offside is. I just don't think we're getting a more entertaining game with it. It just doesn't work, it doesn't flow, and it's just useless.
I quite agree. I mean, a few years ago, we, as football fans, sit around and argue about a poor decision or what we perceive to be a poor decision. And here we are, 3 or 4 years later, sitting around arguing about what we think are poor decisions or what we perceive to be poor decisions. Nothing's changed. There's just a lot of expensive gadgets in every football ground now, in the top tier, and an extra set of referees. I don't see how it's enriched the game at all. You are correct, Graham, in that obviously that more decisions are going right, going the way they should, I should say. But the fact is that football wasn't the Wild West before Sony came along with their new toy, was it?
No.
I mean, it was an enjoyable game where the team that played the best across the course of the season won the league, and the team that played the worst got relegated, and that kind of worked fine for a century. I just don't think it's solved any problems at all, really, because it's never 100% correct. You're still arguing about whether the decision or the call was right.
One of the reasons why football is just so interesting and entertaining a game to watch and indeed to play, is so much relies on luck. It's been statistically demonstrated that about 49% of football is luck. Even with the best footballers in the world, with the best team in the world, you still have a high proportion of upsets and because there's so many things going on in football. It's such a chaotic game that you can get results on the basis of luck, and managers for decades have argued that a good team is also a lucky team. And VAR for me reduces that element of luck by making it by reducing the number of shall we say poor decisions. And in a normal football match, you'll have the referee may well make perhaps as many as half a dozen bad decisions throughout the course of the game. Maybe one of them is actually a game changing decision. We've convinced ourselves that this is a problem that needs to be eradicated. Whereas, in fact, it's been very much the patchwork of football for absolutely ever since we've had officials. Officials are entitled to make mistakes, and as annoying and frustrating as it is when they do it, and as uptight and arrogant and presumptuous that referees can be when after they've made decisions about how they're how they're right and the way. I mean, like, referees tend to attract a certain type of person that really get your back up, don't you? But really and truly, these guys are they are entitled to make this decision. And I would suggest to you on reflection that it's a necessary component in the beautiful game and why the game is just so much fun to watch. And I think that it would be better if we just, acknowledged that this was a very expensive mistake and started to walk back from it. It might well be, that economically, as we face our new coronavirus future, that we might have to do that anyway because it's just going to be too expensive. But I really wonder, whether or not maybe at some point in the future one of the big leagues will go, actually, this is very expensive and it seems to cause an awful lot of arguments. Maybe we're just going to go back to the way it was. I don't know.
No, I think that's a really good point because, they say that beauty is perfection flawed, and we're trying to make something more beautiful than beautiful and actually start making it ugly in the process. So I think it's a real own goal.
Well, there you go. I don't think we can say anything more than that on that, can we? No. Really?
Jan has just won football podcasting.
Yeah.
I hope to play that when I win my award at the Football Federation podcast award. Yeah, that was quite good. Yeah.
Thank good. Good. Well, if you want to watch some football without any VAR this weekend, the FA Cup first round is on, and the BBC are showing a hell of a load of games on the iPlayer. If you go to the iPlayer, you can find out a list of all the ones that are on offer. There are also games on BT Sport as well, including Friday night, which will be Harrogate Town versus Skelmersdale United, and that begins our weekend box set. Some other games in there as well. We've got Borussia Dortmund versus Bayern Munich. De Classica, yes, Terry?
De Classica, yeah, I'm on board with it now. I've been worn down. It is Der Klassiker. Okay, you win. You win, marketing people.
And we've got Cadiz on the box set on the Saturday night game playing in Madrid against Atleti. The mighty Cadiz who've come up and now surprising everyone in La Liga. And if you want to see what we choose to go in our weekend box set this week, then get along to sofpodcast.com, click on the link for the weekend box set and sign up for it. Or if you choose, you can read it on our blog on Friday lunchtime. But that is all we have time for this week. If you've got anything to say about what we've been talking about, like the penalty decisions, if you really want to take issue with us, or if you want to agree with this, then get in touch with us on the socials. And I'm saying this now because we've done pretty well this month. We've got quite a lot of new listeners coming in this month, or whether it's the old ones just coming back. My figures aren't that clever. So if you've only just started listening to the podcast, welcome. And yes, get involved. Talk to us on social media. All the details are coming up during the music. But that's all we have time for this week. So from me, Graham Sibley, from Jan Bilton, and from Terry Fulham, it's goodbye.
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 You can contact us through our website, sofpodcast.com, via Twitter, @soundoffootball, or on facebook.com/soundoffootball.
And, so Terry, you want me to talk about the book as well, don't you?
If you don't mind, just a couple of minutes, so that I can say what it is and that I'm in it and where to get it.
Yeah.
Yeah, 2 minutes, if that, just to plug it, basically.
All I was going to say was just going to recap on last week's episode and then about the book and then just go straight into this book. Say, we got another book to sell to you.
Put it in those cynical terms, why don't you?
I
was hoping he was going to do that
with John, the guest, you know, the broadcaster. Yeah. Oh, John, your book's great. Ooh. And it's me, it's like, yeah, Terry just wants to plug his shitty book.
Well, yes. Yeah.
Some old twat trying to flog his shite to us.
Hawking his wares.
We can't say no because he's staff. Yeah. Here's your 2 minutes now. Fuck off.